on the docket this morning, 08-22-17, Donald Asher versus Bank One.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. May it please the Court, the subject of the appeal are the errors that have been identified in the briefs. The point of the errors began with the District Court's failure to recognize and to uphold the judicial admissions. The judicial admissions are as follows. There was a fraud, initial fraud, in connection with each of the credit transactions. Their second judicial admission was there was no consideration that was ever exchanged at the time of any of those credit transactions. Those judicial admissions are supported by the evidence. The result of the failure of the District Court to appreciate those judicial admissions allowed the Court to first grant the initial partial summary judgment. Code of Federal Regulations says, in effect, and the Truth in Lending Act says, as far as determination of the validity of a contract, that is to be determined by state law. Based upon the judicial admissions, state law should have governed and controlled the determination of when the start of the statute, the limitations period, would have begun under the federal statute. Code of Federal Regulation says that the start period begins with the consummation of the transaction. There was absolutely no consummation. The District Court was troubled by that. I appreciate the fact that the District Court was troubled by that. But that difficulty did not transfer the legal burden of persuasion to the plaintiff, Donald Asher. Similarly, the District Court did not consider the aspects of the doctrine of equitable estoppel in connection with the correspondence by Mr. Asher and the responses by Chase Bank, which were responsive to Donald Asher's notification and identification of each of the transactions, which would have provided sufficient fact basis for them to conduct an investigation as was required by their own policies and by the Code of Federal Regulations. That was not done. There is no dispute. There is no evidence. There's no documents that ever were delivered in response to the production request that indicated any investigation was ever conducted in response to Mr. Asher's disclosures of the fraud.
If we could maybe kind of conceptualize what the claim is here and then the question of when it accrued, because those are threshold questions to the determination of whether the statute of limitations expired in this case. As I understand it, you're making a claim under the Truth in Lending Act.
That's correct. Under the Truth in Lending Act, there's a one-year limitations period. The Code of Federal Regulation says, the language says, that the start of the one-year limitation period is dependent upon the consummation, i.e., the validity of the transaction. There's a gap. We understand there's a gap. But that gap is not resolved by the District Court saying that Donald Asher's position is incorrect. because the Code of Federal Regulations and the case law cited by Chase.
But this is not a transaction-based TILA claim, as I understand it.
It is.
You're out of luck, because if it's a transaction-based claim, then the action was commenced long after the transaction's at issue. My understanding of your claim is that it's being brought pursuant to Section 1643 of TILA, which pertains to liability as between the card issuer and the card holder for fraudulent transactions that appear in the bill.
And that is correct.
If that's the nature of the claim, then it's a claim as between the responsibilities, or a claim for the responsibilities between the cardholder and the issuer, which is resolved well after the transaction at issue, and so the accrual question comes up later.
I misspoke. The court is right. Your Honor is right. It is.
That's
it
always is. A good position to take. Okay. So, if that's the nature of this claim, then when did this cause of action accrue?
The cause of action accrued based upon the discovery. And the discovery has been identified as March of 2003. Pardon me, March of 2004. Because the case was filed in September of 2005.
So even then you'd be late.
Even then we would be late as to certain transactions, but not as to all transactions.
Why doesn't the cause of action accrue when Chase denies your claim?
The first denial or the second denial?
Aren't both within the one-year period? Or am I mistaken about the record?
The first denial occurred in April of 2004. Then there was further contact by Mr. Asher and representatives of Chase.
They wanted time to do an investigation.
They reversed the charges on the bank statements. And there were subsequent credit card statements that were issued in which there was no liability represented. That went all the way through. The reversal was in August of 2004. The subsequent statements for September, October, and November showed no liability based upon the notification that was made and the account statements, which would have fallen within the reporting period, effectively for the billing errors. Then there were subsequent correspondence in which Mr. Asher, believe in October of 2004, said, "You've reversed that. What about the remainder, the $60,000? There's a gap in response. The letter was issued by Chase, Mr. Foster, in January of 2005. And it was backdated to October 2004. So the period of time, based upon the doctrine of equitable estoppel, should have run from effectively January or February of 2005, the one-year limitations period. The district court never addressed that circumstance, never addressed the doctrine of equitable estoppel and the fact circumstance that would have supported it as to at least a portion or part of it. It just simply said, with a broad sword, we're applying the one-year limitations period regardless of what the subsequent circumstances. And I submit, during that subsequent period of time, Mr. Asher, because they had effectively reversed the liability or the charges, could not proceed with a lawsuit because it was unknown exactly what their situation was. The reports that were made indicated that he was not responsible for those particular charges. I hope I've answered the question. the judicial opinions would have and should have done completely overwhelm and contradicted any of the arguments based upon apparent authority. There's no basis for that. And I believe that the court did not properly consider that, because in its second judgment, summary judgment, it again referred to further responsibility on the part of the plaintiff, Mr. Asher, to prove the subject matter of the signatures.
You know, your time is up, but I thought, I'm just going to give you a few more minutes here, but I thought that the merits of this case are sort of interesting. Statute of limitations problems that exist or issues are also interesting, but this is a question really of who bears the loss. It's either the credit card issuer or Mr. Asher.
That's true.
And if the culprit here is somebody who Asher entrusted, who posted fraudulent charges and had access to the records of Mr. Asher, why wouldn't the loss, if we're looking to see who's the most responsible for whatever loss occurred here, look to Asher for his misplaced trust in his secretary, as opposed to the credit card issuer who didn't know McKenzie from a hill of beans? Why wouldn't that be the proper person? And first of all, she's pled guilty. I assume there's a restitution order. Maybe she doesn't have two nickels to rub together, but why wouldn't this case, the right way to look at this case, statute of limitations aside, be who should bear the responsibility for the misplaced trust in Ms. McKenzie?
That argument is worthwhile.
I'm not making an argument.
The suggestion that there's misplaced trust. Misplaced trust should never translate into criminal conduct. Never translate into criminal conduct.
Often.
Pardon me?
It often does.
It often does. But the fact that it does not in any way validate the criminal conduct. And what we're talking about here is criminal conduct that directly affected the contractual responsibility of Mr. Asher. At no time did that transaction or did any of those transactions ever become valid or enforceable. So through the electronic media established by Visa and through the system where there's a factoring arrangement by which Chase had direct and current contact with Ms. McKenzie, Chase approved each and every one of those fraudulent transactions. Chase accepted the account receivable. Okay. Chase becomes the assignee and stands in the place of Ms. McKenzie. That's what the law is. I mean, I understand the idea that there is misplaced trust. That's not an unusual circumstance. But the misplaced trust does not arise to validate the illegal conduct, which affected the contract.
Okay. Thank you. We'll hear
Thank
from
you.
Mr. Rationale. Is it Rationale?
Rationale.
Rationale.
May it please the court, respected counsel, my name is Dabia Rationale, and I represent the defendant, Chase Bank USA NA, in this matter, originally sued as Bank One. Your Honors raised an interesting point with respect to who should bear the risk of loss in this in this situation. There were a couple of cases that we cited to which weren't mentioned by the plaintiff, DBR Architects, which is a case from the D.C. Circuit, and then the Carrier case, which is a district court case from Connecticut. The facts in those cases are very similar to what happened here, wherein there was a faithless bookkeeper who gained access to the business, business's credit card accounts, financial information, personal information, and perpetrated fraud upon this business for a long period of time. In DBI Architects, the fraud occurred for about 9 months. In Carrier, the fraud occurred for about 25 months. In the case at Barr, the fraud occurred from February of 2001 to March of 2004. So for 3 years, significantly longer than in DBI and 1 year longer than in Carrier. In both of those cases, there was fraud. There was illegal conduct. The plaintiff argues that just because there's illegal conduct and there is fraud, that necessarily equates to unauthorized use, and that's not the case. The DBI case and Carrier both stand for that proposition. What you have to look at is, were there payments made by the business, in this case Mr. Asher, to the credit card company such that there was the impression to the credit card company that everything was okay, that there was no fraud that had occurred. Here we have a situation, Your Honors, where plaintiff admits that he received statements regularly on a monthly basis. He received statements and he made payments in full on a monthly basis. So for 36 months, Chase received payments in full, essentially leaving Chase with the impression that there was nothing wrong with this account. In DBI and Carrier, the court held, under those circumstances, when payments are made, the doctrine of apparent authority applies. And TILA recognizes that fact. When you look at Section 16020 of TILA, it defines the term unauthorized use as means a use of a credit card by a person other than the cardholder who does not have actual, implied, or apparent authority for such use and from which the cardholder receives no benefit. Here the plaintiff argues, well, I never received any benefit, therefore I shouldn't be responsible for these transactions. TILA presupposes a contractual relationship and permits cardholders the benefit of the protections under TILA, which is a consumer protection statute, in instances when there is unauthorized use. Here, the plaintiff says, I didn't have a contract. But if you look at the complaint, it clearly says that there's a contract. If you look at the Visa documents that were produced and the contracts that were produced, there's a contract here. There's no doubt about it. For plaintiffs to argue that there was a contract, a general contract, but there wasn't a specific contract for this transaction or these transactions is a novel argument that's unsupported by the record and unsupported by TILA. So Judge Bucklow didn't address that argument. She dismissed both the TILA count and the breach of contract count under the TILA count she dismissed for under the statute of limitations and the breach of contract count because there was no contract term such that the plaintiff in his complaint argued that Chase agreed that it would review every single charge that occurred on Mr. Asher's credit card account to verify to see whether it was unauthorized. As your honors may know, the credit card industries don't have individualized contracts for each individual. So if we were to take plaintiff's contractual complaint, his complaint and this contractual term to its logical extension, that would mean that Chase and Citibank and Bank of America and all the credit card companies contractually agreed to review every single one of their tens of millions of credit card holders' credit card charges to verify the authenticity. Well, that would bring the credit card industry to a grinding halt. And the record is devoid of any contractual term such as that. And the reason it's devoid of that is because Chase and no other credit card issuer ever agreed to that. There are protections for consumers. The protections are under TILA. If there is an unauthorized charge, you must timely review your statement and notify the bank. The bank is required to conduct an investigation. Contrary to what Mr. Dorr stated, the lower court did consider the equitable tolling argument, and they referred to that argument really as a claim that Chase failed to conduct a reasonable investigation under the Fair Credit Billing Act. A plain review of the complaint reveals that there's no such allegation of violation of the Fair Credit Billing Act. It's really just a claim under Section 1643 and a breach of contract. We would submit that Judge Bucklow properly granted Chase's motion for summary judgment as to both the TILA and the breach of contract count, and properly denied the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment as to the breach of contract count. I would tender the rest of my time unless there are some questions, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dorr, your time has expired, but we'll give you 1 minute if you have something to add.
Court asks the question as far as responsibility and who assumes the risk. There's a provision in Visa's regulation allowing for the chargebacks. In this instance, Chase never attempted to charge back any of these fraudulent transactions. Those fraudulent transactions would have been subject to a chargeback to Premier Bank, the acquiring bank. So the liability or responsibility would have, under the agreements, would have transferred back to Premier Bank. The other point is, and counsel is saying, as far as the comment is concerned, as far as what the district court, I believe, overlooked, is the Code of Federal Regulations require that the sales receipts be signed, or else they are not enforceable. That is within the Code of Federal Regulations. On the contract side, there is no contract. So plaintiff's claim for breach of contract, based upon the illegalities of the transactions for rescission and restitution, should have been upheld. Thank you, Court.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under